It's with great pleasure that we present tonight's speaker, my good friend Armando.
My name is Armando and I am an alcoholic. After waiting a month for this auspicious moment, here I am. And to be here and have so many of my friends that have bolstered me, that have provided me with cookies, laughter, so much joy, old friends, I was sitting here, and as people were coming in and the old friends, I was getting giddy. I was just like, wow. And it isn't, you know, and one thing I would like to emphasize, and before I get into all that, is the fact that my sobriety date is March 24th, 2002. That's a little over 24 years. But where I was, what I was getting at, I want to thank Victor and whoever else was responsible for giving me this opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope. But, you know, I was so troubled because I said, you know, I need something, I need a vehicle by which I can get this thing going, because if you don't, then you're kind of like stuck. I know that Andrea and Al, they've heard my pitch, okay? They've heard me. And so, you know, you try not to go over the same stuff, but, you know, because as time goes on, you still say, well, okay, that's not as important. The biggest thing is to talk about is, you know, what we have here, unity, service, recovery, and the steps, traditions. And so I am truly humbled that you guys are here. And like I said, and this experience and what I want to talk about isn't just about me. It's about us. And that's the vehicle I finally came up with, that it is us, that in sharing my experience, strength, and hope, that it isn't just me that benefited through all these years, because by myself, there's no way I could be here and be beaming when my old friend in the back there, Bob, you know, we've been through so much in the past, our experience. And, you know, we're throwing those lifelines to each other. And then some of the guys that, you know, like during the pandemic that we saw each other on the internet, on Zoom. And then here we are, you know, in the flesh, having come out of it after 5 years. But, and, you know, and John and Marcus, and, you know, to run into Marcus, and he's out there being of service, helping somebody do some shopping at Costco. And when he's laughing, it's like, oh, man. And then he lays it on me. He says, Victor, put the word out. I go, oh, no. Oh, that isn't the way I had it planned. But what I want to say is that, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have an original thought. None. I was just here. I was just here, desperate and looking for direction, looking for identification. I had none. I didn't know what recovery was. And you know, and because of the people in these rooms, what I learned was, you know, that by taking those steps and working on that wreckage that I had created, you know, I became a better husband, a better father, better grandfather, a friend, and to be so grateful for all those gifts. And of course, it's all on. It wouldn't be the same if I wasn't into service. But and one of the things that I wanted to say too is that I'm the last thing from being a circuit speaker. I've probably done one of these 4 times. Okay, I'm not a Father Tom, you know, that just, yeah, you know, you're gonna sell tickets and, you know, you're gonna do this and without a hitch, you know. I saw, I was telling Craig and I was telling Victor and that, you know, I had to take some footnotes because I'm losing my memory really fast, And there's nothing more embarrassing than standing in front of people. Yeah, you can talk about your experience, but those key words sometimes that you really think are important, they just don't come out. They're lost somewhere. And then it's like, uh-oh, now what? And so, and I wanted to say too that if you wanted me to do your fifth step, I'm good for it because in 5 minutes I'll forget what you told me. Poof! And you know, another illustration of that, you know, and this is a true story, and I've said this, I've told this story before, where, you know, there was this this construction guy who was rehabbing in Palm Springs, and whether it was fortunate or unfortunate for him, he met this international movie star, Elizabeth Taylor. She was on her second rehab, and for whatever reason, she found something in that guy. All right, she found something. And she got married to him. That was her eighth husband. And all these guys that she'd known, millionaires, billionaires. But here she's marrying this construction guy. So poor Larry. You know, the focus was on him. Every time he stepped out the door, people wanted to shine the spotlight on him and ask him the most obvious question, you know, like, you know, Larry, what was it about you that, you know, that caught Elizabeth Taylor's eye. And you know, after a while, he came up with what he said. And I thought his answer was classic because it illustrates where I'm at. He said, everything has already been done. Everything has already been said. My job is simply to show up and make it look interesting. And that's what I'm doing tonight. So in a nutshell, that's me. I'm going to show, I suited up, I showed up. Craig made sure that I got here, and again, my sobriety date is March 24th. You know, my first drunk was when I was 14, and ironically, as the crow flies that away, Paul Nelson Poole, there were three of us. And this guy had stolen this gallon of Gallo. And so we got into it at night, and there we are. We're drinking this thing, and I got sicker than a dog, and sprinklers came on. I'm rolling around in the mud and the grass, and it's just like so exhilarating, so freeing. It's like so much fun. You know, if you ask me, in a nutshell, if you gave me a minute and said, okay, how would you describe your this disease, your alcoholism in recovery? And I would say it was fun, then it became a habit, and then it became a necessity. I got into recovery out of necessity, and it became a habit, and then it's finally become fun, but fun with, you know, life, living life on life's terms. And that wasn't what I came in here for. I came here to get some relief from this life that I had. The fact that my disease was getting progressively worse, and I was on the verge of losing everything. You know, when I got drunk, my first drunk at 14, I chased that feeling for 41 years. I didn't think that I had a problem. You know, I was totally in denial. I came from a family of drunks. My father was an alcoholic. He was abusive. I had two brothers, and they bore the brunt of his anger. And I never asked him why. I remember when my dad was dying, he decided he was going to do a fifth step with me. And I'm like, wow, I didn't bargain for this. But he laid it out to me, all the things he was doing about the next door neighbor. When the next door neighbors would take off for work, he would go next door and have some fun, and with this guy's wife, and I like, God damn, you know, like, Dad, really? Yeah. Anyway, he thought it was cool. Made him feel better, not me. So that's what he left me with. So again, but for the grace of God, you know, I, out of my three brothers, I made it here to the rooms, and it was a problem for my brothers too, because they went through divorces behind this disease, and I went to we moved here from L.A. We first of all we were living in Arizona, Tucson, and then L.A. and then ended up here in Santa Maria in 61, and I graduated with a class of 65, and was a terrible student. My big thing was when people were at football games, when people were at school dances, when people were at proms, I was out with a bunch of misfits drinking beer in the parking lots and stuff, and that was my thing, you know. I was a terrible student, and I don't know how I graduated from Santa Maria High, but then I enrolled in Hancock, and I thought, well, a new start, maybe this will work. But, you know, at the time, there was this problem with our world, with our nation, with our young people. At age 18, you had to register for what they call the Selective Service Act, where you were subject to the draft. And I can remember me and a friend of mine, we'd be drinking and talking about this, and it'd be, you know, we talked ourselves into the Marine Corps, and it would be like, we don't want to be with a bunch of draftees, you know, they're 2 years and they're overseas at fighting in Vietnam. And I thought, well, if I enlist, maybe I won't get to do that. Well, I went into boot camp in June of 66, and December of 66, there I was on a troop ship with 3,000 other guys on the way over. And that was miserable trip. People started getting sick. You know, there was vomit in the bathrooms, everywhere throughout that ship. And it was terrible. It's a World War I troop ship, and they had the five bunks, hammocks, and that's where you slept. And for a whole week, you know, you had to smell all that stuff. And then after that, things got better. But we arrived in Okinawa, December 24th, Christmas Eve. And at the time, they didn't have, of course, cell phones. So you didn't just pick up the phone and say, hey, Mom, got here safe, you know. Nope. You know, here you got all these guys, and they're 18, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds. You know, those were the guys that were going to go fight this war. And so we did the most obvious thing. You know, we went to an enlisted men's club, and, you know, whatever money we had, you know, for 25 cents a beer, it didn't take much to get it going. And so I thought, man, this is pretty cool stuff, you know. This is what a man does. And, you know, that kind of created this culture for me, this mindset of what is a man. You know, you drink, you fight, and you learn, you know, all these things that you think are so important. And then you know, we trained. I was a replacement for these guys that were in tanks. And 2 months later, there we are in Vietnam. And you know, the things that we did, you know, maybe for what I'm sharing tonight, maybe it's not relevant, and maybe it is. I don't know. But, you know, it was some pretty horrible stuff. And you know, to see B-52 attacks, to see even some of our jets get shot down and so forth. And the crazy part was, for being the most richest, most powerful nation in the world, you know, there were times where we'd run out of water, food, ammunition. And it sticks in your head. It's like, really? You know, what's going on? And then, you know, you go through all this deprivation, and you get through it. So however you get through it, you get through it. However, if you have to compartmentalize these things that you see, you do it. You just do it because you got to move on. But what makes it hard is you come home and you got war protesters taking on our troops as they're coming back. They're throwing eggs, they're throwing tomatoes, they're calling them baby killers. And you know, it's just the first thing you want to do is take your uniform off. If you think you were proud of serving the country, because like me and my buddy, you know, we chose to enlist, and we suited up and we showed up and we raised our hand and we served. And, you know, and I could say, well, okay, so I didn't get hurt physically, but mentally, I was angry. I was angry for a long, long time. And like I said, you compartmentalize those feelings, and you wonder, you know, who's right, who's wrong. And so for me, having come home in the dead of night, you know, I didn't expect a parade. I didn't want a parade. Screw that. You know, I wanted to drink. That's what I wanted to do. I finally get a free chain, get home. You know, my parents are there. And, you know, I look back on that and I feel guilty about it because and shame because I couldn't appreciate that. You know, my family's waiting for me. And it's New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve's my birthday, man. Come on. I know what you do on New Year's Eve. You know, you go get down, you know, you do it up. And no. So my parents corral me and it's like, okay. And I'm gonna, you know, it's just a piece of work. I was talking to, and you know, and what do? You hang out. Eventually, I got out, a chance to get out and hung out with other guys who had been in the service and, you know, just drank and chased women and so forth. But I remember this morning, I was talking to Craig, and one of the miracles of having to do, to lead a meeting of this type, and I thank you for that, Victor, because of the fact that it allowed me to get back into the big book. You know, I read the big book, but it was like this morning, I'm reading Bill Story. You know, Bill Story was an artillery officer, you know, and he made mention of going into Winchester Cathedral, and he was moved by that. And he remembered that later on, you know, as he's having a spiritual awakening. And I can remember later on with me, the fact that I could relate to the fact that I, you know, there's no question that Bill W. had PTSD. And he didn't talk about it, but, you know, he tried to do a lot of stuff, golf and all that. And because of his drinking, it almost killed him. And so the fact that he founded Alcoholics Anonymous is nothing less than a miracle because of all the people that he's saved. And so for me, I am so appreciative of that, you know, that, like I said, I survived. I survived in a whole different level. And how I wish maybe things had been different, but it is what it is. You know, that's what you learn in life. Yeah. Life goes on. Life goes on. And sometime after I got out of the service that I got married and then went to work for the sheriff's department. And I loved that culture. At the time, it was a drinking culture. Some crazy people out there. And I fit right in, you know. I can remember, you know, how... And I'm wondering, you know, whether or not I even fit into that. You know, that's the thing. I couldn't fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in when I was in high school. I'm not sure I fit in when I was in the Marine Corps. And so now I'm in the Sheriff's Department, and everybody drinks. And you know, I can't think of how many times I drove drunk, you know, and the things that I did. I can remember one incident where, and I related, I talked about this at a meeting not too long ago where, I had been drinking at a party, went to bed late. I had to go to work at 6, and I think I got about an hour's sleep. And so literally I went to work, and I was half in the bag. And I remember telling my sergeant, hey, man, you know, I really shouldn't be here, but my wife's, I'll take my chances with you rather than my wife because she's pissed, you know, and like, I had to get out of there. And so he said, oh, no problem. He said, you know, it was a drinking culture. We took care of each other. And he says, you know, have a cigarette, have a couple of cups of coffee. We're going to put you in with a reserve here. And all this information, right, of how many times did I do that, that I would go to work less than, and without any care for my family, for my family's well-being. But on this one particular day, we got a call of a guy who we thought it was a homicide. You know, old guy, he's in his bed, and we followed the trail of blood. He hemorrhaged, went to the bathroom, and we could almost sense that sense of terror that was going through this old guy's life. He died, because nobody there to help him. And what it was esophageal hemorrhaging. And I said, oh, man, you know, look at this guy, you know, just, he could have backed off a little bit. Where, you know, I was making excuses for this guy for my own behavior. And the first thing I could think of, man, I got to get home because I got a case of Heineken's outside my patio. And she doesn't know about it, but I know they're there. And I couldn't wait to get home because I needed to chill. And I don't know, you know, there were, you know, and I can remember all of the death scenes, not all of them, but, you know, some really stuck out. And I would take it personally, not in the sense of, oh, yeah, this, it's going to change my life. I can't do this no more. You know, and I helped with homicides, narc raids and all this. But the suicides always stuck in my head. There was one incident where they called me to Lompoc, and they said, oh, yeah, we need some help out there. So, you know, get there. And they said, oh, yeah, we got a coroner's case. There's a hotel, motel here. And okay. So I go check it out. And I go, oh, my God, you know, what do we got here? And this old gal, I have no idea whether she was old or young anyway. She was done with life. And, you know, and I said, gosh, Darren, you know, just going to make me work. I don't want to put this thing together. What she had done is she laid out plastic in this motel room. And then she gets over by the bathroom and pulls out this 12-gauge shotgun and does herself. And the blowback was like her skull cap was up on the ceiling. And I'm like, I leave out there and I go, I have to step outside and have a cigarette. And I'm saying, gosh, you know, couldn't she have waited till tomorrow? You know, and I'm thinking, I can't find her purse. I don't know who the hell she was. But anyway, here comes the couple of young guys from the mortuary. And they said, oh, deputy, just step aside. We'll take care of this. I go, perfect. See, they're going to do my dirty work, you know, and I just had to put the case together however I could. But, you know, years later, I had this revelation that God puts people in your life when you need them. I needed those two guys because I tell you, I didn't know how I was going to put this thing together, and they did it for me. You know, I just did the paperwork and I said adios, came back to Santa Maria. I was like, that was a tough one. Again, we compartmentalize. And, you know, in whatever the traumatic events in your lives, you know, I put mine in a drawer. I was not going to come home and talk about it. I was not going to come home and talk about it during Christmas dinner. I would say, oh, look at that turkey, you know. And speaking of that turkey, one of my first notifications of kin was in 76 or so. I was just a rookie, literally. And some guy gets killed in a rollover. Coming from the far western there on Highway 1. And so we had to go do the notification of next of kin. It's Christmas Eve. And I still remember the smell of that turkey as it lay there on the counter. And And I'm thinking, wow, when I leave here, I need a drink, because that's what a man does. And so, you know, you man up. It's like, hey, no emotion. Hey, is so-and-so your son? Oh, okay. Is he home? No. I'm sorry to tell you, but he's been in an accident. Oh, what hospital is he in? I'm sorry, he didn't survive the accident. And so, you know, you do the best you can. And you know, you need ice water in your veins, you know, just to be able to hold it together. And it's like, oh, man. And then I got to thinking, you know, all my buddies that went to college during the time that I went into the service and into the sheriff's department, I go, man, you know, they're missing out. Man, look at all this drama. All this drama that, you know, it's like, oh, man, you know, it's like, I need a drink. You know, it's like, I need a reason to drink. And I had plenty of reasons. And so again, there's that denial. And so, you know, as my drinking progressed, I can remember about 10 years before I came in. 10 years. And I remember I'd embarrassed my wife at a party. And what had happened was, I was half in the bag. I was in a blackout. And I told this guy who had brought his wife to the party, I said, hey, I'll trade you. And I'll throw a six-pack in. See, I didn't know all this. It isn't until later my brother says, oh, you were great. You're so funny. We have to do this again. I go, except for... You mean she's not talking to you? No. So I said, well, so to placate her, what I did is I said, well, I'm going to go to an AA meeting. And I did. I went to an AA meeting. And then I looked around. I saw a few people I know going, no, it's not going to work. I'm not ready for this. I took off, came home. And then I came home like a hero, you know. I was like, hey, guess what? I went to an AA meeting, you know. I was like, hey, you know, you should be proud of me. You know, I'm trying to do something. And I said, but you know what? I really don't think this is for me. So, you know, I remember those words till the day I die. My wife said, you know, I never said you were an alcoholic. I said you were an asshole. That's what she said. You know, she was a good, a good horse trader, I think. She knew what she was talking about. And so, you know, 10 years later, you know, here I am. I came into the rooms. My sobriety date is March 24th, 2002. I said that already. But, you know, our last fight over drinking, you know, there was so much of that, was the day before. And it was, you know, that's when I hit my bottom. That's when I had that moment of clarity that I hated who I had become. I had lost control. I had no answers. None. I was finished. All those things that I did when I was drinking, and it was just like the head of a pin of a on the head of a pin, that I had that much clarity, because later on there was so much wreckage to be clean. And then I can remember going to my first AA meeting on March 31st, which happened to be Easter. And then and with the help of my boss, who was sober, the judge, and that's where the miracle became for me. During that period of time, I also went to an AA clinic. I was diagnosed for depression and suicidal tendencies, PTSD, and survivor's guilt. And, you know, and if I thought I was a tough guy, nope. I was just another drunk. That's all I am. You know, whether I want to believe that I should be given credit for my service on behalf of the country or my service for the community. No, I'm just a drunk. That's all I am. A garden variety drunk. And I can remember my first meeting where page 31 was read, the methods, you know, and And it's such a cool thing because it stuck with me. I can't remember. There were a few people there. Jack S. was there. But when they read the methods, you know, drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, all that stuff, all the way down where it says accepting voluntary commitment to a silence, we could increase the list ad infinitum. And, you know, those were things where I was trying to control, maintain, and enjoy my drinking. I had done all those things, and that stuck with me because now I'm hearing something. If I had to hear anything, that was it, you know? That was important to me. And the fact that I could relate. And, you know, and as time went on, you know, I took the steps. I got a sponsor, tried to repair the damage I had caused behind my drinking. And you know, I never told my wife that I was sorry. Never told her because I had done it all these years. So here I am my first year of sobriety, and until I hit that 365, that first year, total year of sobriety, did I apologize? Did I say, hey, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for everything I said and everything I've done. And I thanked her for, you know, for staying. And she said, well, that's all great and good, you know, because I don't know, you know, you put together a year and, you know, you've manned up. And it became a deal where I'd be renewing like a one-year contract, you know, like a baseball player. You know, 1 year, see how it goes and see what my numbers are anyway. So things started getting better. And you know, so many things happen in that. And that's my first year. So you look at the next 4 years and you know, I had deaths in the family. My brother died. My father died. At 14 months in sobriety, my grandson was born. I mean, I want to tell you, I wanted to drink over that one. I wanted to raise my grandson up to the heavens, you know, like Lion King, and say, hey, you know, there's my legacy. I need to drink over this, you know. And I can remember being at a meeting, taking off, going home. I was like losing it, you know. And just like like it says, a doctor's opinion, where, you know, that that men and women drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. And I was irritable, restless, and discontented. And I was just like crazy. And two people called me because they noticed that I had taken off. They saved my life because somebody cared. Somebody picked up the phone. I had, moving on to, you know, the next year or so where I was trying to sponsor two guys. My first sponsee, he was in law enforcement, and so he knew I was in law enforcement, so he came in to the rooms because he had a drinking problem. However, he also had a problem where he went out and got a massage, and there was a sting operation going on, and he got nailed, and this was out of county. So, unlucky guy, you know. And his wife was a major player here in city government. If that complaint had been filed, he would have lost his job. I'm sure his wife couldn't have handled that humiliation. But anyway, he said, well, we don't know what the DA is going to do. So, okay, well, so we started working the steps. And we did 1 through 3, and then time went on. 6 months, 9 months. And I started talking to him about, oh, when are you going to do 4 and 5? So one day he comes to me and says, hey, I did 8 and 9. I said, I cleared up some wreckage with my sister. I go, okay, what about 4, 5, 6, and 7? I said, ah. He says, and then He says, maybe in another month. Well, another month comes along. He's got a year now from his incident. And there's a thing called statute of limitations. 1 year, if they don't file, it's gone. So, you know, this guy goes, I'll see ya. And I was butthurt over that because I thought they're going to give me an award. They're going to give me a medal, you know, and at least a cup of coffee. And I was so confused. And I took this to a guy that had about 100 years of sobriety. And I said, hey, you know what? I'm really pissed off about this. And he says, well, let me ask you a few questions. Is the guy sober? I don't know. Is the guy happy? I guess. I don't know. Is he still married? I guess. He says, okay, so I'm going to ask you a fourth question. I go, okay, shoot. He says, what about you? Are you sober? I go, yep. I go, what's the problem? What is the problem? And I learned from that. You know, my second sponsee come along, and that guy, he got nailed because he was flying an airplane while under the influence. So he was a doozy. He was very smart, very bright. He was good looking, great family. And I backdoored him into a program that we had, electronic monitoring. And so I had him, and we were on, he was going to get clear of all his charges and his time served and all that. He had about a week to go, and this guy committed suicide. He couldn't handle it. He couldn't handle the fact that he was being watched, he was being monitored. And what I learned from that is sometimes when it comes to sponsees, that you can do too much for them. It's like, hey, you want to do it? This is the way we're going to do it. You can't coddle them, because when you do, you can kill them. And the thing to do is you work with them. You give them what you have and the rest. And so after that, I was blessed to have two sponsees who wanted this, who wanted it, wanted to do the work, wanted to do that fourth and five. And who benefited, I don't know, me, 100 times more than what I gave them. And, you know, and doing that fifth step, you know, you realize that you're operating on a deal where you're in contact with your higher power, you're in contact with yourself, you're in contact with this other human being. And it is a very intimate time, not sexually, and but heart to heart, soul to soul, and you lay it all out. No, I'm sorry, I meant this guy. But the thing is where we. I'm sorry, is, you know, the steps, that's why they're, for me, 1, 2, 3, you know, where you turn your life and your will over to God every morning, 10, you do those inventories, and then you get into service, just like all here. And you know, and I want to say that, again, there's so much, you know, and I've learned so much about, you know, like I said, there's five things that I want to share with you, and I'm going to let it go at that. It's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. You know, those are the five steps you go through when somebody's terminal, they're dying. Mm-hmm. You know, denial, they don't want to accept that they're angry that they have this, and they start bargaining. They say, okay, God, you know, if I go to church, you think maybe they screwed up on the test. They could, when that doesn't work, now you're into depression. Then finally comes acceptance. And what I have found out for me, that those five things, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, are those emotions that I had to go through as I had to make this change in my life, this to get any kind of spiritual growth, that I had to go through those things. I denied it. You know, it was my wife's problem. You know, that's why I drank, because she couldn't validate all what I was doing, and the fact that I couldn't tell her all the things that I saw. And it isn't until later, you know, maybe you know, I started talking a little bit, but not much. It's still, you know, I just don't think it's important. But I've been able to share it with other people in these rooms. And that has saved me. That has been so much. Again, I know that those feelings and emotions, I can remember sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, they're talking about, well, you don't drink, you don't do this. And then they started talking about those feelings and emotions, and they're like, I want to hear about that. I want to hear what it was that propelled me. What was it that got me here? But yet at the same time, that I could sit and listen. And I've done a lot of listening, I think, and I've been able, and people have listened to me. That relationship that me and Bob have throughout the years when he was struggling, and there have been times when I had to call him. There have been times when I had to call my inner circle, and they're all back there, you know. They're just making sure that I don't change my story, you know. So and having to surrender. I was going to say that at 5 years, I lost traction. You know, it was like, what is this all about? Just meetings. And what it was, I hadn't fully surrendered. I still had some baggage. And so when I took the steps again, and I was more honest, I had more experience. And I took this on my own because I wanted it. I wanted this life. I wanted to be able to be here. And if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have been here. I would have missed it. I could have missed it. Seconds and inches. And I'm here. I'm so glad to be here because, again, my story is your story. My pain is your pain. My joy is your joy. And I think of all the times that I could have drank because I was too happy, too sad, too bitter, too cynical. And you know, those things come up. You know, because I took the steps, it doesn't mean they're erased. It just means that they were taken away. But they still come back. It's who I am. And I try to pray over those things, those character defects, and know that they'll always be there, and I have to be careful about that. If I heard anything at all, and I'm gonna, this is another point, and it's funny because I wasn't here for Father Tom, but I had heard one of his DVDs where he said that for every year that you're in sobriety, you pick up 1 second of pause when agitated. And so the more time you spend for every year, yeah, that's another second where you can pause. And I think that's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing because that's a gift. And there's so many gifts here. So, again, I want to thank you all for being here, for supporting me. Again, this is our story. And I couldn't have done it without you. This is a WE program. This is a WE program. I'm humbled. I am truly, truly humbled. Thank you very much.
Good job. Another hand.